The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Happy to be here. I feel a little bit proud even, and a little bit nervous, because I don't know you, and I don't know the kind of problems you have. And I like to cater to problems, so maybe if I have been going on a couple of days that this man is so simple-hearted, it's almost stupid, then I have done something wrong. Or maybe I was too difficult for you, so you couldn't follow it. That's another possibility. Or I've been going too far. So just to find the level of things is difficult for me, as I'm talking in the beginning, at least as an art historian. But I didn't want to go on as an art historian, because I'm asked to talk on Christianity and culture, and this has always been one of my dreams, that on theological schools they would discuss culture. But talking about culture, we don't mean only art. Art really is just a very small portion of our life. It is just as natural to life as eating, but you don't eat always. And eating is not everything, even if it's important. And just the same, art is a part of our life, very important, and we can't miss it. And of course, it would be very stupid, particularly for theologians, not to think about it. Just a couple of weeks ago, I had some person coming from some Bible school. Let's not tell the whole story, it's too involved. But he asked me, is there any need for art for the Christian? And I thought it was very silly that this question was asked, because this man was very interested in evangelism. I said, now you're not interested. In fact, the case was like this. At this college, this Bible school, they had laid out a course, Christianity and Art. And the main problem in that course was, why do we have the course to begin with, and what has art to do with Christianity? Well, that's why they came to me, at least to have somebody say something about it. And I said, I think this is completely silly, because you don't know why you're talking about it. You don't think it's important to talk about it. And next time you have an evangelistic drive, the first thing you do is that you have music and you hand out posters, and all that is art. And you should think about it, what you're doing, and it's silly just to miss it. Well, I don't want to talk about issues like this unless you ask me for it. But the first week, I want to do something special. I want to introduce in a few moments. Then the next days, I want to lay out a little course in art history, up till and including this arts weekend or conference that we have at the end of the week. And next week, I want to do other things. By that time, I hope we got to know each other enough that we can discuss what are we going to do. I can go into matters of what is art history, or what is certainty in art history, or other topics, and we can discuss. And I just want to do what is most valuable to you as you are here, and I'm not interested in hearing myself, basically. So that about the course up till now. We hope to discuss more in the future. So tomorrow I want to go into slides, give a little presentation in art history, in a way to raise problems and questions, and I hope that people will make it difficult for me in this sense, that you ask me questions. That is the best thing for me that can happen. Then I know what are the problems, then I can go into it, at least try to. I learned something myself, because questions are the most important thing in the world. The right questions are the beginning of wisdom. So come with your questions, please. At this course, I hope to insert question time if I'm not talking too long, as I usually do. So come with your questions at the question times here, but in between, give it me in written form if you have no time to really talk to me, or come to me and we'll take time for it in one way or another. So please don't leave me in the dark, but with come with your questions. So as I said, to me this was very difficult to lay out the course, because I think Christianity and culture is very important topic for everybody, because it just means that we live. You see, if we, as evangelists say, be saved because Christ is the source of life, then we got to fill in that notion. It shouldn't fall into nothing, in a void, because we're talking about something, and life must be there, and art is just a natural part of life. It's not life itself, it is a part of it. It is something that belongs to it and has a rightful place. And in a way, all of life is culture, the forms that we give, not only art, but many other things. In a way, our life is the expression of what is our inside. It comes to the outside, and that's what we call culture. So culture is always there. It is the forms we give to life, even to liturgy. It's not confined to anything special. So art should not be looked at in a narrow way. Certainly culture should not be looked at in a narrow way. Therefore, it was very difficult to me to know where to start. I don't know you. I know some of you are very advanced, some of you are not advanced. Some are very advanced in art, and probably some are very advanced in theology, but are still wrestling with the first problems concerning art, like the question we just heard, which is a good question. So I don't know how to handle it, and so I thought that I just begin somewhere with something which is very much on my mind, maybe just to bring it forward to you, and I hope it's part of the discussions we're going to have. It's talking about something which I think is there when we talk about culture, and it is reality. What is reality? What simply is the world that we are living in? It's part of the things that we make. It's part of the things that is there. What is reality? And if we talk about art, as we do in the coming days, we talk about reality, because, and that is one of the theses that you will find, that art talks about reality, and it ought to talk about reality, and in a way it is making reality. So reality is very important to think about. And I think that in that field some of our most basic problems today are there. You know, there's lots of discussion going on in Christian circles. For instance, the discussion about evolution and Genesis 1. And I think problems like that can only be solved if some of the very basic problems are solved that I hope to present to you just this morning. I hope that I get ready. So that's why I want to talk about reality as a kind of introduction to introductions. What is reality? Formerly, 50 years ago, in the time of your grandparents, if your grandparent happened to be a well-to-do European, this person would go in his vacation, in their vacation, father and mother, they would go by train down to Switzerland, and then they would change the train, and then they would change the train again, come in the tram, and in the end up they would just come to a little station, and at the station when they get out of the train, there would be the hotelier, the man who is having his little hotel there somewhere along the lake, and he would be standing there, and they would get off the train, and he would get their trunks, and he would say, "How do you do? Very nice to see you again, and we have, of course, reserved the same room for you." And these people had been there for 25 years in that very same little hotel every year from the 1st till the 23rd of June. Well, the very first day, they make a little tour. When they came in, they said, "It's very nice weather. We make a little walk." And they walked on the very well-known, well-trodden paths that they have been gone to so many times. This is not nostalgia I'm talking about. It's life. So when they come back, they will say, isn't that a pity? How come that at that particular point, this beautiful tree has gone? And the man would say, yes, we had a big storm last year and so on. I said, we will talk about the loss of the tree, which has left a hole in the universe. And this is a reality. You see, these people in those days could go every year to the same place. Why? Because they were not afraid of reality, because reality only becomes real if you come there every time and you begin to understand it, you see. So if you go there every time, you go deeper into reality, you get to know it more, and knowing it more, it gets more important for you, you get more into it, it becomes the world that you know. So you deepen your contact with it, you get roots in such a place. That's why people were not afraid to go back to the same place and felt no need to go to another place, because another place would be having a new acquaintance and that would be very much work, and they knew that they were limited, and to know just that little beautiful place in Switzerland was enough. In a way, they deepened their knowledge of reality. They were not stupid, they were wise, because they got a real good grasp on the nature before them. They began to love it. There was a real relationship. That's why you can weep over a tree which is destroyed by a storm or something. That is a reality which I'm talking about. I think this is reality, the world around us, and that we got to go into, to get to know it and to grasp it, and then it becomes real. If you're there the first time, you don't see things. You got to know them in going, because, and this is a slogan that I will repeat over and over again in this course. It's one of the things that I've learned in many, many years, and I begin to understand slowly. It's this, that we see what we know. We see what we know. That's the only way that we can see. So this reality that I was talking about, this little tiny place in Switzerland, this is loaded with meaning. Reality is loaded with meaning. It's out there. And in a way, we only have to grasp it. But it's difficult. It just doesn't jump on us. We got to discover it. And so we see what we know. The more we know, the more we see of that meaning of this reality. I'm very sorry. They should have done that. There's no blackboard here. But reality, I tried to find it out one day to give it a little formula and say reality is fact plus meaning. So reality R is M plus F. Reality is fact plus meaning. So you have the factual, but it's more than just the factual, it's the meaningfulness of it. I have discarded this completely because I think it's just confusing, because, as I hope to make clear in the course of these days, facts don't exist. Maybe I will come back to that in a few moments. Facts don't exist. My definition of facts is that what we all agree upon. You see, 200 years ago, America was founded. Why? Because we all agree upon it that 200 years ago. Maybe someday, one of these days, an historian will find out it was 201 years ago, and then the whole celebration is a fake, of course. But we have decided upon that it was 200 years ago, and that's why we call it a fact. If one person says it's not true, it becomes a subjective argument, a subjective insight. There are, and I would say one of the things I have in my Dutch library, we have many discussions, and I've learned in the discussions that there's one word that I'm the most afraid of all, when somebody says it's obvious. So be very careful with the word obvious. As soon as somebody says it's obvious, it means that uncritically he accepts something to be a fact, which probably isn't a fact. So be very careful. And that's why I would say don't talk about facts, but say that reality is exactly the meaning of the things. The things, the meaning is the reality of it. And there is no reality outside of that meaning. You see, what is let's think about an example. Well, a marriage ring. You see, somebody has a marriage ring. One of those things you look at nostalgia with. To, you know what they say in England today? Because in England they are further than America at this moment, if I listen to Dr. Clowney this morning, they say nostalgia is just isn't what it used to be, you see. And so you can have nostalgia about nostalgia. Well, you see, this is type of things that you just look at rings and so on. But what is the meaning of a ring apart from the meaning that it is a marriage ring? You see, it's a little piece of gold. That doesn't mean a thing. So the meaning is the thing. And the reality of that ring is the fact that it is a marriage ring and it belongs to such and such and so on and so on. Now, if you take it very precisely, we see what we know, then in a way you were caught, because you can never you cannot see what you don't know. That means that we are caught in what we know. But that's not true, because, and I think that's peculiar of man, that man can look creatively. So we look in the world creatively, and with imagination we find new things. So we look very attentive at reality, and we see things, and we see things that we have never seen before, and we look with all our imagination to grasp it. And the imagination is not something that crazy, silly, out-of-the-world artists have, but that's the man who looks through the microscope for his biology studies. He sees their forms under the microscope, and then his imagination must work to understand how it is laid out, how these cells are related to each other. And so in his imagination, he begins to see things, he discovers new things. And that's a very difficult, in a way, even a painful process. Most people are very, very lazy. Most people look very carelessly, and that's why they know so little. Or the other way around, they know so little, and that's why they look so carelessly. But, and of course, the education means opening eyes, showing things to people. You see, you go through a countryside, you see, look at that tree. It's this and that type of tree. And then the other one says, oh yes, I've never seen it before. You see, it's more than just the eye, the light beams. Many people think that seeing, in a little sense seeing, is something that's obvious. Everybody has it, but I would say it's not true. One of the most interesting courses that I'm giving is going with first-year students to the museum. I never give that course to younger colleagues of mine. I love to do it myself, because it's fascinating to have people standing before a painting and say, now just describe what you see. And then they look at you and say, this man is crazy, you see what you see. But then in 2 minutes they find out, as soon as they begin to describe, that they don't see. And it takes 2 hours even to begin to see a little painting, just to see it, not describe it, not interpreted it, but just to see it. And that's a fascinating business. So it's something creative, it is something difficult, and we need all our imagination. And imagination is not fancy, it's not going on. No, I'm talking about reality. And so in art, and we are seeing ever new things. And the meaning is out there. We try to grasp the meaning which is out there and to bring that into our orbit, into the world of our knowledge, so that we may see it. In a way, that's the artist's task, and it's all our own task. And of course, we bring to the artist what we know. Of course, this is an endless job. It's infinite. Why is it infinite? Because reality is infinite. Is it really infinite? Because God is infinite and reality is finite? Yes, but it's in this sense infinite that it's much more than we can ever grasp. So the whole of history, how long history will go, will be too short that we grasp everything that is to be grasped. So we only know a little bit. That's why artists in the past could paint a painting, and today, out of the same mentality, paint a painting. I'm not talking about other changes. But and then paint something new, because there's always something new to be grasped. Reality is never the same. Even these people who for 25 years go to the same little place in Switzerland see new things every time. And that's the fascination. That's exactly the fascination. Just because they know something, they are open to see new things. If you don't know it, you just get only on the superficial side of it, and you don't know things. I think this is one of the points I'm going back a come back to that later, but maybe it's better to put it at this point. I think we have lost this. We have lost it. You see what we do in our vocation, certainly in America, but we begin to do that more and more in Europe. We drive 5,000 miles in our vacation. And every vacation we go to a new place. And we never go to the same place. And I think the basic reason is because we are afraid. So we do something strange. We feel we have lost the grip of nature. So we run to grasp it. But as soon as we would have it in our hands, we go away because we are afraid to get in touch with it, to begin to love it. So we just drive away. So it's a kind of alienation, it's a quest for reality, and at the same time, the flight from reality. It's a kind of something double. I think that's the crazy way we arrange our vacations. Americans coming to Europe and seeing in 2 weeks, Stockholm, Rome, Paris, London, Berlin, Amsterdam, and then back again. And thinking that they have seen Europe, they haven't seen anything. They could just as well stay at home and look at a few slides. That would have been more sensible. But why don't you go to one little place, a little place in Switzerland, a little place in Holland, and be there for 2 weeks? Then you have some real experience, and you get to know something. Of course, it was only the beginning of knowing something. But then you get to love something, maybe. Maybe you return there, and you forget about the rest of that country. You see? But then something real comes. I think that we have a very thin feeling for reality. This means that something has changed in our understanding of reality. This is what we were talking about on vacation. We search for reality, but we are afraid of it. Reality, in a way, is too strong. I think here at this moment that this beautiful little metaphorical book of C.S. Lewis, The Great Divorce, the real reality, that's God's reality, that's heaven, is so heavy, while the evil is in a way non-existent. And it's really very heavy. The spiritual is something heavy. It's too heavy for us in a way. In a very little sense it's heavy, it's material. And the spiritual is material. This heaviness is very important. Something happened in history. May I tell you a little story, which is a true story, and one of the strangest stories that I can tell. Somebody, Mr. Santorio Santorio, and it's an Italian physician from Venice, wrote a book in 1614. When the book was published, everybody says this man is completely crazy. He had done experiments. Nobody went and tried the experiments again. You see, if I would say, go outside, all the flowers are in bloom, there is no snow, or I don't think that anybody would run outside and see whether I was right or wrong, because it's too silly to think about. It's certainly not true. So in the same sense, these people did not try to renew his experiments, because what he said was so silly, it was obvious, here's the word obvious, it was obvious that he was wrong. Some people even thought that he should have to be put in an insane asylum. Some people even thought that the Inquisition should get hold of him because he was a dangerous man telling silly stories. You see? So this book was written in 1614 by Mr. Santorio. What was in the book? I hope I've roused now your attention to what he has written in that book. The book was this. This was his experiment. You have a very big weighing scale. So, very big. And on one side of it, you have a table. Then, loose from the weighing scale, you have a chair. And now you go to a bed in the morning, you wake up somebody, and you lead him. The man is just groggy from his being very much asleep. You put him in the chair, and in front of him you put a cup of coffee and some cornflakes and the rest of it. You give him a breakfast. And what's happening now? What's happening to the weighing scale? What's happening? Well, the man is gaining weight. That's what you're saying. Yes. Everybody would say that. Of course, the man who is sitting on the chair on the weighing scale, you see, and having eaten, he is getting heavier. Everybody in this room agrees that he's getting heavier. No? He gets lighter. That was everybody was saying in 1614. You're a bit old-fashioned. You see, in 1614, everybody said, it's obvious that you get lighter. You know, you come very heavy out of bed, very heavy, and then you get your breakfast and you get lighter. Everybody knows that. And now this man had put him on the weighing scale, and now they had found out that, or he has found out that it was heavy. And everybody said he's crazy. Nobody even tried to redo the experiment. And I think this is very important, because in that time something very, very deeply changed. Because now we began to look at man as if he is a bunch of atoms. Because in the atomic sense, in the very material sense, of course he is heavier. But man is not just material, and there is much more going. And it's much more obvious to say, of course you're getting lighter in the morning, that's why you have breakfast to begin with. You see, you get lighter, otherwise you would never make class, because you're too heavy to go, you see. So this is much more reality. So, but we think, almost everybody, that, yes, what is the difference between a life body and a dead body? You see, I have a scale, there's something on it, and I put something to it, it's getting heavier. Now I have a man sitting, I add food to him, he is getting heavier. But I treat the man as if he was a dead body. You see, he is not an alive body. There's no difference anymore. These stories, which are in the very interesting book of Vandenberg, which is also on the list, one of the most important stories that he tells is about the heart. In 1300, precisely, they began to cut in the human body, anatomy. And one of the first things they were very interested in, began to look at it, is the heart. And they found what was obvious that everybody would see and couldn't fail seeing is that the heart consists of two parts and that there's a hole between the left and the right-hand part of the heart. It goes too far and too deep to discuss the understanding of the heart that came from Galenus and from the old physicians' theories. It means something that blood is made in the liver, and that substance, which is not blood yet, but is nevertheless something blood-like, is brought to the heart, and in the heart something is added to that substance, and what is added is air, warmth, and spirit. And now this spirited substance is going out in the body, and that is life. You see, that's the life substance. So the man who was cutting there in 1300 for the first time in the body, he could say, I love the Lord my God with all my heart, because the heart is the center of life. Where is it? Somewhere in Proverbs or something, in one of these books, out of the heart goes all of life. You see, all our activities come out of the heart. The heart is the center of life. These things you find everywhere in the Bible. He could say that with confidence. And this is actually what happened. But if you follow those theories, then there got to be a hole between the left and the right-hand side of the heart. And everybody saw that hole. Until a man came, Vesalius, that's the middle of the 16th century, that is 2.5 centuries later, 250 years later, that man said for the first time, there is no hole. Again, everybody said, you're insane, you're stupid, you're crazy, you're dangerous, and he had a very rough time after that. Really, he was just put in a very unimportant place, he couldn't publish anymore. It's a very bad story, because everybody felt something very big is at stake. Again, nobody tried to look, because it was obvious that this great, great anatomist, he's the greatest anatomist of all history, and he knew that in the 16th century, this greatest of all anatomists, this man says something silly, and it's dangerous, because it means there's something wrong with the heart. The solution is coming, and listen to all these dates, 1300, and now we're already in 1628. That means 14 years later, as that man with his scales. Harvey, in 1628, publishes his book on the blood circulation. And he says in the center of the book, and therefore the heart is a pump. The heart is a pump. Yes, there was something to be added. For Harvey it was like this, that the blood that went from the heart was heated and spirit was added. There was a life spirit added to it. So he tried still something to retain of the old system. But basically the heart is a pump. So now it's obvious that this is our problem. The problem of today, what shall we say? We love the Lord our God with all our pump. Can you say this? And if you cannot say that, what is your heart? And what does it mean if you say, I love the Lord my God with all my heart? What does it mean? Is it just a symbol? Nobody in history ever thought about it as a symbol in the sense that we understand a symbol. But just at this moment, the whole sense of symbols change. Something that we have added to it, some idea that we just put on it. But it's not really there. The love, your God, your heart, with all your heart, is a strange symbol. And it's obvious that it isn't true. You cannot love the Lord your heart with your you cannot love God with your heart because it's obvious your heart is a pump. Very strange. I think that these are the problems that we really have to deal with as Christians in this century. If this problem is solved, there is no discussion anymore about Genesis 1 versus evolution. Of course, the evolution theory is crazy and silly. And if I was not a Christian, I would never believe the evolution theory. I think it's a strange hypothesis, which is, well, I'm not going into that now. But whatever it is, it's trying to solve a big problem. And it is maybe a strange answer to it. But Genesis 1, what is it saying? What is Genesis 1 really saying? Are they talking on the same wavelength? Are they answering the same questions, really? Genesis 1 and the evolution theory. So even if the evolution theory is not a very solid theory, what is a right theory? And what kind of things can we say there? This type of problems, I think, will not be discussed anymore if we have to solve the big problem of what is your heart. And of course, that is a metaphor in itself, because I talked about the heart and about your weight. But you can just expand it into many, many, many things. In a way, all our lives. Owen Barfield, in his book Saving the Appearances, talks about this and he calls it participation. He says this is a very important concept. In the old pagan religion, it was like this, that all things were participated. Because if you looked at them, then there was something that the things were more than they were. There was something behind it. There was a God who was manifesting himself or itself maybe in that stone or in that water. So people who are working in the Peace Corps in the Third World have great problems. You just want to make new wells because there's a draft and there's water under the ground. But people say, oh, don't make wells. Because you wake up the spirits, and it's dangerous. You see, that type of thing is participation. The water is not just simply water, it's a representation, it is an expression of something which is more. The spirits are there. It is loaded with some kind of spiritual meaning in the sense of spirits, demons, or whatsoever. The idols are there. Of course, the idol is not just a sculpture, but the idol is a sculpture which is loaded with meaning, so much meaning that the power goes out of it. Don't touch it. You will fall dead on the ground. It's loaded with meaning, like a highly strong electric current. And that's what Barfield calls participation. There is something there. The interesting thing is that the Bible says no to this. The Bible says it doesn't exist. The things are all created by God, and they are not dangerous in this sense. You may make wealth. And I think that we never realize enough how much freedom, Christianity, biblical thought has brought in the world. Just a simple thing that you can say, this is like this. You see, if I would ask you or any other school in Philadelphia, what is lightning? People would say, oh, that's just electricity. It goes like this and this. Very simple. But before Christianity came, nobody could answer that question because nobody could even investigate lightning because it was dangerous. Because it's a wrath in the hands of the gods. So you better stay out. Then Christianity comes, and I think the most important moment in history, the most important moment in history is when Paul was on Mars Hill. And it's not in my Bible, but I'm sure that this happened, that he opened his Bible on page 1, and he said, now look here on very first page. What does it say? That God created the world, and there's nothing in this world which was not created by God. And this moment in history means complete freedom. Because now we can investigate lightning. Now we can go into all these things. Now the world is open. So it's a very important thing. Does it mean that the things are now just what they are? Electric currents? Of course, the things are not godlike. But they are loaded with meaning. They are loaded with meaning. So we read Psalm 19. Just look at the mountains. They speak, even if they have no voice. You see, there is a power there. You see them. There is some expression. There is something that hits your eye. And in the end of Job, Job is asking big questions about this. God say to come out to me. Were you there? Can you explain this to me? And you get one of the most fantastic explanations of reality. Poetic, we say. For 20th century man, poetic means almost a lie, but that's the really true reality that God is talking about. More true than all the atoms and all what all the physicists today can tell. Because, of course, we know today much more in the macro and the micro physical sense, but we know very little about it because we have lost the true meaning of it. It's only atoms. C.S. Lewis said once, people always discuss what is the sun. Is the sun hot gases or what is it? But were those people really crazy once upon a time, fell on their knees and adored the sun and called him my God? And I don't think they were silly. Because the sun is a life power. Only Christianity made man free. They didn't need to adore the sun because the sun is a creature. But we must understand that the sun is not hot gases. That's only what the sun is made of. But what it is made of is not the thing itself. You see, and that's very important to note. I see human beings before me. I don't see bunches of atoms before me. I don't see so many percentage of water and so much percentage of this and that and that. I see human beings, of course. There are atoms here. There is a kind of all these different physical aspects of you. Well, that's what you are made of, but that's not important. Not in the very deep sense. You see, so reality was made free. God's name is I Am. So God is not naming himself after anything in reality. He's not saying, I am the sun. Or I am the moon, or I am this or that, he said, I am, because God is before anything was. So one of the biggest discussed issues in this world, as everybody knows in this room, is the discussion about nature and grace. You see, there's a part which is a natural part, there's a part where God, the Bible, the church, theology has something to do with. It is the higher spiritual part of man, and it is the simple natural part of man. This concept is very old, since the Middle Ages and even before. I think it's one of my big battles. It ought to be the battle of all of us. I think this is completely erroneous. It's detrimental. It's killing life. It's a very dangerous thing. There are things that out of God's hand, if we talk about nature and grace. And there are things that are maybe too much related to God. We forget that Christ did not come to make us Christians in the sense of grace, but that Christ came to make us human in that full sense, including everything. So there is a dividing line, of course, but the dividing line is between reality and the Creator, because reality is creation. That's the equality. So reality is creation. And so there is a very strong basic line, and we can never go over that line as human beings. We can never go away from being creatures to being the Creator. That's an absolute line. God is the Creator, and this is created reality. And we, of course, are in that created reality. We are part of it. We are creatures. That is, but there is no line in creation between something that's holy and something that's only natural. In a way, everything is very natural, being reality, and being created by God, everything is holy, loaded with meaning, nothing accepted. Of course, God created the world, but he is working in it. Maybe that's the shortest definition of the gospel. God created the world, and he is interested in it. That's the shortest definition that I know of the gospel. God created the world, and he's interested in it. We see much of that in the Bible. That's, in a way, the message of the Bible. Very interesting, one of the most beautiful stories in the Bible at this point is Elijah on Mount Carmel. You know, he had his sacrifice, lightning fell from the air in order to get the sacrifice burning and so on. And after that, because the big issue was rain, it had been dry for I don't know how long, many years, and the issue was if people would say that God was Lord, then there would be rain. So after the sacrifice, the whole of the people of Israel shouted, "The Lord is God." So Elijah goes from Carmel and he prays to God. He said, "Lord, you have promised that if this happens, you will send rain." What does he expect? It's very interesting what he does at that moment. He sends his little servant up the hill and he says, "Look for the clouds." So he was not expecting anything strange. He was not expecting rain falling out of a clear sky, because God is not going to change the world. Rain is falling out of clouds. So he prays, "God, send rain," and he sends up the little servant, "Look for the clouds." And I think that's a very telling story. God is working in the world, of course, through clouds. There is never any rain falling without clouds. We shouldn't expect that. So creation, and of course there's been much discussion about this in the course of years, centuries. Creation, people have said, is just like a watch. God made a kind of super watch. Well, what we have against that metaphor is that the watch is running by itself. And that's exactly what they mean. God made the watch, and there it is. That's our universe. And then he just looks at it, how it goes. Then I would say God is victim of the watch he made. God is victim of the watch he made, including all the mistakes that are in the watch. That's what we call sin and so on, death, and all these things. But it's not true, because God, I would just follow up this metaphor and say, yes, God created the world like a watch. But the greatness of our God is that he created the watch and all the little wheels are free. Of course, if we make such a watch, then in a fraction of a second, the whole machine stops because it's chaos. But the fact that we look around in this world, it's not chaos, testifies to the fact that God created the world like a watch, with all the little wheels free. There is not a chaos, and yet there is freedom. This is fantastic. This is the great things that we're talking about. That means that the things are loaded with meaning. God is, these clouds are God's clouds. Lightning is God acting. When we read in the story of Luther becoming a Christian, or becoming the great reformer, that lightning struck very near to him, and he was aware God is working, that he was not acting as a fool. He was really acting truly, because God was acting in the lightning. But nevertheless, it is lighting, and that lighting can be explained as electrical currents and so on going, because we're free to investigate. Because it's no participation, and yet it's meaningful. It's not participation in the sense of the pagans, that the things themselves are gods, are loaded with demonic power, and so on and so on. You see, so you can touch it, and nevertheless it's real. In the Middle Ages, we had a worldview which was, in a way, something in between. There was, of course, very much biblical thinking, but also something pagan. For instance, in all the Middle Ages, people had a kind of ambivalent view on astrology. Of course, it was wrong to think, like the pagans, that you can predict the future. But, of course, this is dangerous, of course. Of course, everybody said in the Middle Ages, it cannot be denied that the course of the stars has an influence on your life. You see, that's a kind of participation. There is something more than you see. There is this relationship. Nature was seen as something vital, and what they were trying to do in their science and in their philosophy, and of course that's one, is trying to understand the quality of things. What is it? What is its essence? How does it work in this world? And the work in the sense of what is the power that goes out from it? So it was a vital, qualitative, substantialistic way of thinking, asking for the substance of things. So what they were not doing is what we do today, is functionalistic thinking. We only ask, how does it work? In the sense of what is the structure of the relations. We make models. We say, this is the way it works. We make formulas. You want to change the tape? Okay. So today we think about relations, mathematical relations. We make models. That's functionalistic. Medieval thinking is completely different. So if you are in any way interested in history, and you've got to be interested in history because you read medieval books, then you got to know what these people are talking about. It's a different reality than we talk about. Because for them, the most natural thing in the world is to say, I love the Lord my God with all my heart. For them, they became lighter when they took their breakfast. And they were interested in the essence of things and not in the functions, not in the mathematical equations. Of course, one thing is very silly. It's the most silly thing, and it's taught in all schools in America and in Europe. And the silly thing is that people think that people in the Middle Ages were so stupid to think that the Earth was flat. Nobody ever thought that the Earth was flat. Yes, there were a few stupid farmers way out somewhere in the country who thought that the Earth was flat. Maybe there are still some farmers or other stupid people today, even in America, who think that the Earth is flat. But apart from those few children below the age of 10, apart from that, everybody knows that the Earth is a ball. So, and the medieval worldview is one of the most beautiful worldviews in the world. If you want to read more of it, then read this beautiful book of C.S. Lewis on the discarded image. And he says, this is the way they looked at it. And it's like this. The Earth is the center of the universe. It's a round ball, and we're walking on that round ball. By the way, around the equator, it's so hot that you would burn if you go there. So we can never know what's on the other side of the world. Although it's a round ball, you can never know who's living in Australia, whatever it looks like. This was one of the great things that later on they found out it wasn't that hot, even if it is hot, but not that hot. And so you could go the other side. But it is a ball. And around that ball were other spheres. And on these spheres you had the different planets. And so you got from sphere to sphere to sphere. And then you came to the last sphere. That's where all the stars were fixed. In the midst of all that you had the sun, who was the giver of light. The sun gave light to everything, all the planets and all the stars, you see. So in a way, they were all reflecting. So you had the sun, and of course, he had the sphere around the Earth too. It was a very beautiful picture, the Earth in the middle, and then all these circles, these spheres, balls really, and then the last ball. What's behind the last ball? That was a question that people before the Middle Ages never dared to question, because nobody could understand it. For the Christians, this was a very simple thing, because behind the last sphere there's God and the heavens and so on. And you can draw another picture of the earth. And that's a real picture of the world, and it's this, that God is in the center of everything. And around the God, you have all kinds of spheres, the sphere of the angels. And of course, you have the seraphim and all kinds of different orders of angels. And so around God, you have all these orders of angels. Still, you come at the border of heaven, of the heavens of heaven, you come at the border. And they're just outside of the border, outside of the city of God, that is where man is. So the very interesting thing is that the medieval worldview has two complementary views. In the physical sense, you have the world in the center, and then all these balls, and God is outside of these balls. And you have another spiritual picture where God is in the center, you have all these spheres, and then at the outside of these balls, you have exactly where the earth is. So the worldview of the medieval man was not God is in the center, but not man is in the center, but you can call it anthropospherical. That means God is, man is at the sphere of it. Very interesting that this goes into the life forms of man. Panofsky has written a very fine article on Suger, S-U-G-E-R, Suger, S-U-G-E-R. He was one of the greatest men in the 12th century. Well, you can simply describe him, just to put it in one word, he was the creator of the Gothic style. So this man who changed the outlook of the world and the arts and his understanding of the church and liturgy and all that, this man, Panofsky said, was a man full of pride. But the interesting thing is that his pride, his quest for fame, was just centrifugal. It went away from him in the thing. So whenever you stand in front of a Gothic cathedral and say, isn't that fantastic? What you're saying is, Suger was a great man. But you don't know Suger. The interesting thing is that this changed later, and it is somewhere related to the story with which we're talking about. And for instance, an early example of that is Michelangelo. And with Michelangelo, all the fame is centripetal. It is related to him. So you stand in front of a Michelangelo, then you say, look, that's a Michelangelo. And then you say, it's a Michelangelo. You say, it's a fantastic Michelangelo. And they say, oh yes, what does it represent? Oh yes, it's the night, or it's Christ, or it is a Pietà. Or, you see, that's completely secondary. You forget about it because you were talking about Michelangelo. With Suger, you say, look what a beautiful church. Look what fantastic sculptures. Look at all these saints. And you forget about Suger. You see, that's the difference between an anthropocentrical and anthropospherical view of the world. And so the medieval man was anthropospherical. But you have these two complementary views, and both are true. The earth is in the center. But that does not mean that man is in the center. It means exactly that man is at the border, at almost out of the city, just at the border of the city. He is waiting to be let in, which will happen at the last days. For them, for the middle-aged man, his view on the world was like this. And they talked, for instance, about the hermeneutics, interpretation. And he said, you have the literal, you have the moral, you have the allegorical, and you have the anagogical way of explanation. The literal is that the story is the story. Samson and Delilah, his haircut, and so on. There's a moral implication, not too difficult to think about. It's allegorical, it says something about humanity. It says, for instance, to the man, beware of women. You see, and in that sense, it's allegorical. Of course, there are also men who are very dangerous sometimes. I'm not talking about against women t- today, nor does the Bible. So there's allegorical there. And then this anagogical, A-N-A-G-O-G-I-C-A-L, anagogical is a kind of direction. It is the thrust in which it goes. It is the mentality which speaks through it. It leads us to God or it leads us to the devil. It's the kind of thing that's in it. Well, this type of thing they laid out, but it's interesting, you don't find anything about symbols in this way, because the symbols belong to the literal. You see, to say that something is a symbol for it, that means that it is it. What is the American flag? Well, the American flag is the American flag. That's not a symbol, that's the American flag. You cannot say just a piece of cloth that we have given the meaning of the flag of America. That's crazy thinking. And crazy thinking is modern thinking, you see. So we should be very careful that, and I think that the medieval man was right. He understood better. The American flag is the American flag. That is the literal meaning of the flag. And everybody says that just a piece of cloth doesn't know what he's talking about. That's what the flag is made of. Of course, the flag is made of cloth, and if you don't have good cloth, the flag is destroyed very soon by the wind. So you got to take care to take good cloth. But that's what the flag is made of. That's not the flag. The flag is the meaning of the flag. You see, that's why I say reality is meaning. And the medieval man still understood these things. But one of their problems was nature and grace. No, not going into it, but in the end of the Middle Ages, you see that nature is growing very much, and in a way, by the other side, grace is growing very much, but they go outside of each other. So on the one hand, you have mysticism, and on the other hand, you have the new movement, which we talk about more, and that is the new worldview. That is the modern time. That is what began between 1300 and 1628. Between Mundinus, the first professor ever to have anatomy there in Bologna, Mundinus, in 1300 and 1628, when Harvey said, the heart is a pump. In those 300 and something years, that's the point of change. Things don't go quick in history. It takes time, and therefore they are so deep, because it takes time, because it's a new way of seeing. It's a completely new way of looking at the world. And if we look in a new way at the world, it means that we understand the world differently. And it is so because we see what we know, and our knowledge is different. So our seeing, our knowledge is different. It has changed. It's a new visibility. These people saw things in the past that we never saw. So people say, look, the middle-aged man was blind. He didn't see anything. Just look at their paintings. They even didn't know that there was space. And I would say, no, you're wrong, because they know more about reality, and they talk about it in a symbolic way, because that's the literal. But we have just discarded that everything, and we look to the factual and put that in space, and now we got to add meaning. These things happened in Florence. Why do people go to Florence? Why is Florence all summer full of Americans? Well, there are two reasons. The first reason is that it has four little stars in their guidebook, and everybody said you got to have to be in Florence, because then you're a cultured person. So everybody worked through Florence and couldn't be bored more, because there's nothing to see, because they don't know anything, you see. And I think that's one of the tasks of American teachers, to teach people to see something, because unless you know something, you don't see anything. So there's one silly reason why people are in Florence, but there's another reason, a much deeper reason, because the new era begins in Florence. You see, never believe textbooks, because they're the most silly books in the world, particularly art history textbooks. So, in the art historical textbook, you find that the Florentine Renaissance is the Renaissance. And outside of that, you had only backward people who didn't understand. But the people in Siena, just 1 hour by car from Florence, were having a completely different art. They did not follow the Renaissance. Why? Because they had many good objections, many good objections. They were not old-fashioned, they were fighting for something which was valuable, and they were fighting for values. So the new world begins in Florence. Of course, all our history books and art history books are written out of that perspective. Out of this comes the modern time. Just one little word in between. In between is the Reformation. The Reformation stopped it. Stopped this movement, and it was postponed for two or three centuries. And I think that's a great moment in history. The Reformation, and I would just add immediately also the Counter-Reformation, is a new understanding of the world. They fought, at least the Reformation fought, and certainly the Calvinistic Reformation fought for the dissolution of the mistaken understanding of the world that there is a difference between nature and grace. He said, no, there is one world, it's creation. And they understood that Moses was talking about many things that people were calling secular. And in a way, the secularity of the world has come in because of this, because God says, for instance, you may, Israel, you may sacrifice, no, you may kill an animal to eat it. You may. But you will never kill an animal to make it a sacrifice but in the temple. So God says there's a place in the temple, that's the place to sacrifice, and nowhere else. Why? Because this, we should not make them into participatory things. We should not make the whole of the world pious, but there is a place for the secular, just the eating of meat.